In 1931, a book called Little House in the Big Woods was published by a farm wife who lived in Missouri. 80 years later, that book and the others that followed have been read by millions of people all over the world. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Laura Ingalls Wilder eventually wrote 9 books based on her life. Generations of readers know and love young Laura, her pa, her ma, her big sister Mary, and her little sister Carrie, and of course, her good old bulldog Jack. Today, we will talk about Wilder's work and why it continues to resonate with today's readers. My guests are two women who have lived and breathed Laura Ingalls Wilder since their childhoods, and we'd like to hear from you. What do these books mean to you? Have you shared them with your children? Why do they endure? Join the conversation after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. If you hear the names Pa, Ma, Laura, Mary, and Carrie, there is a very good chance that you know who I'm talking about, even if you've never sat down and read one of the books by Laura Ingalls Wilder. Those books, starting with Little House in the Big Woods and Little House on the Prairie, are a cultural phenomenon. Generations of readers have connected with spunky little Laura and also learned a great deal about the history of our nation and the pioneers in the process. Today we're going to talk about those books. We're going to talk about why they endure and the legacy of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And my guests today are Laura experts. Sarah Utoff is a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College, and she travels around giving speeches and also portraying Laura Ingalls Wilder. And also with us, Amy Lauders is an assistant professor in the communications department at Minnesota State University in Mankato, and she is the editor of the rediscovered writings of Rose Wilder Lane, literary journalist. And of course, Rose Wilder Lane is Laura's daughter. So we will be talking about her a little bit as well today. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Oh, we're always glad to come out to talk about Laura.
Absolutely.
And I normally, when we talk about a famous person, we refer to them, this is a journalistic thing, we refer to them by their last name. But Amy, looking at your website and reading about the conference that you organized, Laura Palooza, you made it very clear that we're supposed to say Laura.
Yes, it's definitely Laura. I'm not sure why we don't refer to her as Wilder, but she's just a little more personal to us than that, I think.
I want to ask both of you, and Sarah, I'll start with you. When did you first read these books?
I can't even remember when I first read them. Somebody told my mother that since she had a little girl, she ought to get a copy of this set of books. And so she did, and she started reading them to me, and both my grandmothers read them to me. In fact, I recently just found an old audio tape. My mom used to do these family history recordings where we'd tell about what we were interested in. She asked, "What's your favorite thing to do?" And I said, "Play Laura." And I made my little brother be Jack. It was typecasting.
And how about you, Amy?
Well, you know, my family knew the Ingalls family in generations past, and so I was very small. I remember being about 5 when I was bothering my grandmother, who was visiting with a friend of hers, who turned out to be a cousin of Laura's, if you followed all of that. But she introduced me, Laura's cousin, Ruby Martin, introduced me to the books by saying this: the girl that was in them was her cousin, which was very exciting for me when I was 5.
Well, I think it's still exciting now. So
yeah. It was really exciting, and that got me started reading the books and got me hooked on Laura.
Now, for a lot of people, I think we read these books when we're in, I don't know, first, second, third grade, and then a lot of people move on. But for both of you, there was a special connection that kept you almost tethered to these books in a way. Sarah, what do you think it was that kept you playing Laura? You played Laura as a child. You play Laura today. So.
Well, there's just so much in the books, for one thing. I always say they're like an episode of The Simpsons. There are so many levels. You can reread them over and over again, and every time you're going to find something new. They're just incredibly well written. And then besides that, there are all these beautiful descriptions of nature and the prairie. And I think a lot of people also want to be Laura. You know, you don't hear too many people saying they want to be Mary or Ma or the grown-ups in it, but someone who wants to be a little bit rebellious, somebody who admits they're afraid of doing things like going in front of strangers or going to school or teaching school, but knows they have to, so they buck up and do it anyway. And I don't think this is quite as true for me because I had a fairly strong family growing up, but a lot of people tell me what they find in the books as adults and that they found as children was the real family aspect, as there are people today who don't really have that kind of close family, and they sort of can have it vicariously through the books.
What do you think, Amy?
Well, I think Sarah Sue's definitely onto something there because, you know, I had a very strong family background too, so that wasn't something I noticed so much, except that that was a family like mine. But I do think people are looking for that, especially if their families didn't have that same sort of togetherness. I also think, too, we take away different things from the books as we grow. We have another friend, Sandra Hume, who's editor of the Homesteader Newsletter, who's mentioned that now that she's a mother, she really identifies with Ma and Caroline Ingalls and how she managed her family. And has often stopped herself by, you know, when she's disciplining her own children by saying, "What would Ma do?" You know, so this sort of thought that there is something we can take away from these books from the time we're small to the time we're adults, and something different each time.
Now, of course, these books were written toward the really the end of Laura's life. She was in mm-hmm. her 60s mm-hmm. when she wrote these books. And I know you both have done a great deal of research about her, so we'll sort of take turns here. But Sarah, how did these books come about?
Well, it's an interesting story, and it probably starts, well, with Amy's expertise, Rose, because mm-hmm. those of you who aren't aware, Rose Wilder Lane was a very strong, vibrant, famous woman in her own right. At one time, she was one of the highest paid magazine writers in the country. She covered the aftermath of World War I in Europe and was the oldest known woman correspondent to cover the war in Vietnam. I mean, she just was very famous. In fact, if you look at the WPA roadmap for sites to see in South Dakota from 1938, it doesn't say Laura Ingalls Wilder in DeSmet. It says Rose Wilder Lane, birthplace. So at the time, Rose was really famous, and I think that sort of gave Laura the idea. Now, she had actually started after they got the farm together, because they ended up with over 200 acres improved land and finally started to make some money off of Rocky Ridge. And then she...
And that was their farm in Missouri.
In Mansfield, Missouri. And she, having gotten their farm going, really believed in the small farm country life and wanted to reach out to other people. So she used to go around and talk to all these women's groups and things. And she had what she called her chicken speech, which talked about all about how she was going to make a dollar profit per chicken and how you really should be out in the country living this small farm life. And one time she couldn't go, so she wrote out her speech, sent it, and it was read to the audience, which included a man named John Case, who was editor of the Missouri Ruralist. And he said, "Aha! I have found my homemaker's columnist," and hired her. And after that, she published articles roughly twice a month in the Missouri Ruralist from 1911 to 1924. In 1924, she retired, I think partially thinking that it was now time to write her books, because she'd been talking about this forever. There's all sorts of people who say, "I was the one who encouraged her to write the books." And I think they're all right.
They all encouraged her to write the books.
This is one of these things. You know how people all get this story or they'll have the project in their heads and they'll come up to somebody and they'll say, "Oh, how did you do this? How, you know, I ought to do this. What do you think?" You know, to a bunch of different people. I think she did this for years. And then she finally started writing in the books. So in 1928, she sends it out through Rose's agent and to all the publishing houses. They all turn it down flat. So Rose shows it to her friend. Well, as a picture book author yourself, you appreciate Berta and Elmer Hayter were friends of theirs. "For the rest of you, they wrote The Big Snow, a Caldecott-winning book. You ought to read it. If you haven't, it's about the blizzard at the beginning of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer." So you know the kind of thing they did. And, well, it's the same blizzard. It wasn't the set in Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. So they looked at the book and said, "This would make a great children's book." So they... Laura and Rose together worked and came up with the picture book like the Haters did, sent it around to all the publishers again. Again, one more time, everybody said no, except Knopf Publishing, that said, you know, this would make a good junior chapter book. Rewrite it.
So write it for kids, for young people.
Yeah.
And I'll let Amy pick up the story here again. I know that you both are so steeped in this history. So Amy, once this book was sort of making the rounds, what kind of role do you think Rose had in shaping it and editing it?
That's an excellent question, and one that's actually debated quite a bit in the academic circles. But, you know, Rose, being as famous as she was in her own right, and I think Sarah Sue did a great job going over that, she really had the connections to let something like this see the light of day, A. And B, she had the skill set. She was a trained writer. She trained herself, and she was very good at what she did. And so I think it was Rose's connections that allowed the books to even get play with Knopf. And, of course, there was some problems with Knopf. They eventually got rid of their children's book division before they could do anything with Laura's book, and eventually she ended up with Harper and Brothers, who released the first book, Little House in the Big Woods. But, you know, with Rose's help, I think Laura was able to kind of apprentice with Rose and learn how to craft her stories in such a way that they would be, become what they became, the children's classics that they are.
When you look at the columns that Laura wrote for the Missouri Ruralist, have you actually been able to find those?
Oh, yeah. You can find them in several books. There's the Little House Sampler and the Little House Reader by Bill Anderson. And then there is Stephen Hines every few years comes out with a new format to republish them. The Little House in the Ozarks, probably my favorite version because it has Herefords on the cover and we like Herefords. But they have been republished on numerous occasions.
When you look at that writing and then you look at the writing in the books, do you see the similarity between her writing style there? Obviously, she's writing in a very different way, but do you see the writing chops from those early columns, Sarah?
I do, especially in the It's kind of a hard column to explain if you haven't read it, because sometimes she's talking about her own farm. Sometimes she's talking about public events of the day. Like there's one talking about the Lincoln Highway and how they wanted to plant trees along the edge to honor the soldiers that fell in World War I. Then you get things that are stories from her childhood. And there's a couple just beautiful things that she talks about that. And a couple, not too many, but a couple stories that actually make it in the books later. And I think it's obvious it's written by the same person. Now, there are a lot of people who are fans who don't really care for the columns that much. But I personally, as somebody who lives on the farm, I think maybe I appreciate it a little bit more than some other people. And when I used to work in circulation desk at the public library, I always recommended anybody who was doing a house remodeling project would read the two articles. They didn't actually appear in the Ruralist, but came out about that time, the farm kitchen and the farm dining room, because I think she's got so much good advice in there about how to set things up so it's easier to not have to dust and this and that. And I highly recommend them.
All right. Well, we will continue our conversation about Laura Ingalls Wilder and her books and her legacy in a moment. I'm talking today with Sarah Utoff and Amy Lauders. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the books and legacy of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And with me today are Sarah Utoff. She's a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College, but she's well known for giving speeches about the life and times of Laura Ingalls Wilder and portraying Laura Ingalls Wilder around the state and around the region. She also has a website called trundlebedtales.com. Amy Lauders is an assistant professor in the communications department at Minnesota State University in Mankato, and she's the editor of the Rediscovered Writings of Rose Wilder Lane Literary Journalist. She also has a website where you can read about Laura Ingalls Wilder. It's called beyondlittlehouse.com. And we'd love for you to join the conversation today. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Amy, one of the reasons that I'm asking so much about the writing style of Laura Ingalls Wilder. Now, of course, I know that there is in the academic world, there's a lot of debate and, you know, talk about how much of an influence Rose Wilder Lane, her daughter, had on her writing in these books. But the reason that I'm interested in it is I've just sat down to read them again with my 5-year-old daughter, and I'm blown away by her writing. She has such a beautiful way of using language. Her descriptions of the prairie and of the landscape are really so fabulous. And as someone who loves the prairie landscape, you know, I didn't remember that her descriptions were so beautiful as a child. I just loved them. And it's been many years since I've sat down with the book. So, you know, to think that a woman who was in her 60s, who had written some but not a lot in her life, sat down and put this beautiful prose on paper, it really makes me curious about that process.
Well, and I think there's a lot of curiosity out there about that. I agree with Sarah Sue in terms of, you can see when you read the Ruralist articles, you can tell it's the same voice that wrote the Little House books. But I also think that Rose was extremely helpful in terms of helping Laura figure out how to craft a narrative with a plot, you know, all those plot points and things, specific characters not cluttering up the storyline with too many people. For example, Nellie Olson is actually 3 different women or young girls that she encountered in her life that she just gave one name to. And these kinds of influences are those of a professional writer. However, you know, that thick description that you're talking about, those descriptions of the prairie and those descriptions of her childhood and her life could only have come from Laura. When you think it through, I mean, these were experiences that she went through, things that she did. And one of the things that just struck me so much about that description was when I visited DeSmet myself, and I went to the homestead, and I stood on that top of the hill at the homestead, and I looked out toward town, and there it was, exactly as Laura described it, that place where the Pearson's livery barn was, the big slough right there sloping down in front, the whole bit. It was just eerie. And I was just amazed that her memory was as good as it was, that she could describe it in such perfect detail that, you know, a century later or 80 years later, I can read it and go to the homestead and stand on the hill and say, oh, my goodness, this is the spot. And I might not have even needed to know that that was the homestead to know that that was the spot. You know, so that was a gift she had, and I think a lot of people attribute that to her need to describe things for her sister Mary, who was visually impaired and couldn't see. She was asked to be her sister's eyes. And I think part of that, too, comes from the fact that she was part of a family of storytellers. You know, Charles Ingalls was a storyteller, and the Quiners were all very literate and a lot of writers on that side of the family, too. So I think that Laura came by her gift honestly, and Rose certainly inherited it. But she did have the polish and the training to help Laura really make those books what they became.
Sarah, how biographical are these books? I know that they're based on her life and her family's travels, but how much do we know about how accurate they are?
Well, they are historical fiction, so they're not exactly how everything. Things were sometimes rearranged. Characters were kind of put together. Somebody who she met in one book maybe would really be another character later on. So it isn't like they're 100% accurate. And there is, of course, a long time of memory in between where, you know, you kind of – it isn't like she was writing about what was happening to her now.
Right.
But I think on the whole, they are a very accurate portrayal of what it was like to live out on the pioneer town. Now, it's a very narrow viewpoint from a young girl. Mm-hmm. Other people would definitely have other viewpoints about the same things that were happening, and she leaves out a lot of stuff. But what she presents, I think, is very accurate.
Well, I find myself, especially in reading the first 2 books, you know, Laura does a beautiful job fleshing out her own character. Mm-hmm. From the very start. Laura is, you know, a little girl that you can relate to immediately, and you get to see some of the things that are going on in her mind and how she's feeling and how she's acting. Some of the other characters in the book are a lot flatter. You know, mm-hmm. there's almost a saintly characterization of Pa and Ma, and really particularly Mary. No mm-hmm. little girl can be that good, can she? Mm-hmm. But do we have, Amy, I'll ask you, do we have much insight on who these other people really were? I mean, what, obviously, Pa, Charles, led the family on many adventures across yes. the plains, and he couldn't have been just the loving father that we saw in the book. I'm not saying that he was not a good guy, but there had to be a lot more going on there.
Well, yeah. I mean, when we think about what Laura was writing, she was writing from a little girl's perspective. And I think that if in a family structure like the one she had, you would tend to idolize your parents when you're small. And you start to see as the books progress that, you know, she still idolizes her father, but there's more more tension there. And we start to see it, I think, in By the Shores of Silver Lake. And when Caroline says, no, this is the last move. Charles agreed to that before we made it. And you can sort of see that there was tension there between Caroline and Charles in terms of how often they were moving and where they were going. Caroline was domestic. She was a Victorian lady, and she wanted to raise her daughters in a civilized atmosphere. And so there was a point where she put her foot down, and Charles said, okay. I think he would have been content to keep going. But yeah, in terms of the characterizations, I think you can see the progression, Laura's maturity with those relationships as she grew too, that people became more three-dimensional or become more three-dimensional as we grow. And when we see Caroline in particular, I think about her, you know, she was Ma. She did all sorts of things for the house, and she was always sweet and gentle and even-tempered. And then in By the Shores of Silver Lake, you see her tell the girls to go upstairs. There's a house full of men she doesn't know. She tells the girls it's bedtime, and she hands Laura a sliver of wood to lock the door with on their way up. And you realize that Caroline knows a great deal more than just how to wash dishes and cook. I mean, there's hints of that kind of tension all the way through, and it gets more progressively. We see more and more revealed about those two.
Sarah?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think you really do see that growth and progression through the book, just like Amy says. Pa, we look at him because Laura looks at him as this sort of idealized figure because she loves him so much. But if you really look at what he did, he was kind of a fly-by-night guy. He always mm-hmm. had some get-rich-quick scheme. That was part of the reason why they in particular, though it really wasn't uncommon to move that much, but that was part of the reason why they in particular moved around so much is because he always thought there's going to be something better. I'm going to do this, and then all this wonderful stuff's going to happen. And it never mm-hmm. did, really. They finally did prove up the homestead, but I mean, there's all sorts of stuff. Like if you look at the land transactions in Walnut Grove, and he had a homestead, and then he had a tree claim, and he did the preemption and then sold it again the next day for less money than he paid for. I mean, some weird stuff was going on there. He had always thought he was going to do better than he did. And he really took his family into some pretty dangerous situations when yeah. he really wouldn't have to. So I think there's definitely more to Pa than you get in the early books. And Ma, too, she definitely was an accomplished woman who knew a lot of stuff, and Laura doesn't really appreciate that until the later books, but you start getting it in the last few. And Mary, when Mary did say something that was out of character, Laura, in her original autobiography, Laura would switch it to being Laura in the books.
Well, we'll talk more about these books in a moment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the books of Laura Ingalls Wilder. And we're talking about those books, why they've made such an impact and connected with so many people for so many generations, and what the legacy of Laura Ingalls Wilder is. We'd love to hear from you at 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We've been getting some comments on Twitter today. One was, she was my favorite childhood author, such an ability to evoke my imagination and about a place I could relate to. And I think that for many of us in Iowa and also in the other Plain States, that's definitely part of the connection for us. And it is interesting to note that tweeter is a male. And I think we do think of these as girls' books. But do you, when you talk to Sarah, when you talk to kids who are getting into Laura Ingalls Wilder, do you talk to a lot of boys who've read these books as well?
Yes, there are a lot of boys. And Laura was always pleased when she heard that a boy was reading them, too. And while you get the sort of stereotype that there's more women interested in, and there probably are, at least, you know, a slight majority, but the two most well-known biographers of Laura Ingalls Wilder, William Anderson and Johnny Miller, are both men, and there's lots of little boys love it, especially the Jack scenes in A Little House on the Prairie. I get a lot of comments about them.
Little boys love the little bulldog.
Yes.
How about you, Amy? Do you feel like this skews mostly toward girls, or do you hear from boys who also love these books?
You know, I probably don't encounter as many school children as Sarah does on a regular basis, but I do know that they're appealing to boys on a lot of levels. My brother, for example, liked the farmer boy chapters with all the food. all of the food that Almanzo tried to eat at one sitting. You know, that was, there's definitely something appealing to both genders here, but I would say that most of our crowd skews female.
We have Stephen Luce on the line now. He is the executive director of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Park and Museum in Burr Oak, Iowa. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Charity.
And Burr Oak is in far northeastern Iowa, and the Ingalls family lived there for a short time. This is not a story or part of their life that actually showed up in any of the books, but when did the Ingalls family live in Burr Oak?
From the autumn of 1876 to 1877. So about a year's time, but parts of 2 years.
And what did they do there?
Well, they did a couple different things. First, they moved into the museum building we have, which at that time was a hotel. And Charles and Carolyn helped run the hotel. And Mary and Laura, at the age Laura writes in her unpublished book, helped do dishes and make beds and around the various chores of running the hotel.
And how long has the museum been there?
Well, there were some local community members who purchased the building in 1973, but it opened 100 years after the Ingalls were here in the bicentennial year of 1976.
And what do people who visit the museum see?
What do they see?
Yeah.
Well, they see the building that the Ingalls family lived in, as well as we give them an understanding of what happened in the town, because the Ingalls, during that one-year time, lived in three different places. So even in 1 year, they couldn't hold still, right, and stay in one place. So we share the story of Laura coming as a 9-year-old and then leaving town as a 10-year-old and what went on during that time. So they see the hotel building that has all the different rooms set up with antiques and various things. Some artifacts of Laura's that the Mansfield, Missouri Museum has given us so that we would have some actual Laura artifacts. And then hear the stories based on a couple of books that have been written about the Burr Oak experience.
And you actually have people there at the museum sometimes who portray Laura as well?
We do. Sarah's been here before, that's
right,
for
but
sure.
I saw on your website that you have a young Laura. You have auditions for a young Laura.
We on the fourth weekend of June have our Laura Days, and part of that is a contest for a Little Miss Laura, 9, 10, 11-year-old girl, and any young Almanzos the same age that would like to. They put together an essay. They go before judges. They develop a costume, and we use them as an ambassador then for the year. So when they're selected, they went to the state fair and were in the county tourism booth for one shift helping talk about our museum as well as the county's resources. And they ride in our covered wagon in the local parades and, you know, do a little bit marketing publicity that way for us. And then they talk to school groups that come in May for field trips to, you know, about being Laura, why they like Laura, and the general sense what they have, what you could do to become a Little Miss Laura.
I just think it's a really great program because a lot of the sites have a Little Miss Laura where it's just a lookalike. But Baroque does such a marvelous job actually involving the girls and having them work with the museum and really get some experience under their belts of getting to go out and talk to people. And I think it's just a wonderful experience for both the girls and the museum. And I got to be a judge twice.
Well, that's fun. And I can imagine that's just a dream come true for, yeah, for little girls or for a few little girls.
Or a dream
sure.
shattered if they don't get it. Yeah,
yeah, that's the downside.
It's hard for them to sometimes deal with that. But
well, what kind of traffic do you get at the museum?
What kind of what?
How many people visit every year?
Oh, there was a reinsurgence of number of guests when the television show started based on Laura's books. But we still get between 6,000 and 7,000 a year in a site that isn't even mentioned in her published books. So guests from, well, this year so far, 48 of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia. Last year we had 49 of the 50. This year we got Rhode Island. Last year we couldn't get Rhode Island. Now we're waiting for Vermont and Maine to come through. So,
but certainly there are a lot of people who Laura really resonates with around the world. Stephen, you sound like you're actually out on the frontier right now. We don't have a very good phone connection, so I'm going to let you go. But thank you so much for joining us
today.
Well,
I did want to share, Charity,
sure,
what Amy said about keeping the story simple. We have a letter here from Laura saying the reason she didn't put it in her books is that it would be in too many characters. And you have to hold the reader's interest to the principal characters, not scattered among so many.
Sure, I'm sure they interacted with a lot of people if they were running a hotel.
Quite so.
All right, thanks a lot, Stephen.
Thank you, Charity.
Stephen Luce is the executive director of the Laura Ingalls Wilder Park and Museum in Baroque, Iowa, which is way up in northeastern Iowa. And Betty is on the line from West Side. Hello, Betty.
Yes, this is West Side, Iowa.
Okay.
We're 70 miles straight west of Ames. The reason I'm calling in is because in 1993, the Grantwood Education Agency sponsored the first annual tour of visiting all the places that Laura Ingalls Wilder lived in the Midwest. And there were two van loads of librarians, teachers, daycare people, all seeking 3 credit hours. And it was really the highlight of my teaching career to do this, and the 17 years have gone by, and I know I have presented at least 40 times, you know, to various groups and school kids and even to kindergartners about Laura Ingalls Wilder. So I'm sorry I missed the first 20 minutes of your program if you started at 10.
Well, maybe you can listen on the computer later on. We will be putting it up on our website, iowapublicradio.org. But, Betty, what was the highlight of that tour for you?
Well, actually, by the time we got down to Mansfield, we had the privilege of meeting Nita Seals, who was a companion of Laura and Almanzo, and she and her husband would drive them around, you know, in their later years, and also took a trip out to the West. And she had lunch with our group of students there. Actually, we were students, and she was quite adamant that the writings were Laura's, you know. And that controversy's probably been going on for years, and no doubt will. But she was just very adamant that Laura was the original writer. And I can see where her daughter Rose would, you know, give her input because she was an author herself. So,
well, Betty, what was, I know you were a teacher?
Yes, but what librarian.
Was, okay, what was your original connection with the books? What made you want to be a part of this tour?
This is weird because I had never read her books. She died the year I graduated from high school. She wrote the books before I was born. And as it was in years ago, if the teacher didn't read some of these books to you, you know, you were totally lost about them. So I was aware of the whole thing because of the TV programs. But so I had to read all the books prior to or during the trip that we were taking. And I, too, just thought, oh, what a great thing, because she lived it. She, you know, she didn't have to make up anything because she had lived it. And
so that must have been a powerful experience to discover the books
really
and see the sights at the same time.
Yeah, it was 2,000 miles when we did the seven states. We did go to Burr Oak and then to Pepin and then to Walnut Grove and then to Desmet, drove through Nebraska down to Independence and over to Mansfield and ended up at the Herbert Hoover Library, and where we actually got to see her writings, and they gave us a very nice packet of things to, you know, promote Laura. And just, like I say, I've given so many presentations that just because people are still fascinated.
Well, Betty, thank you so much for your call today. And if you have a story to share, give us a call at 866-780-9100. Maybe you discovered these books as a child. Let us know what they meant to you, or you shared them with a grandmother or a mother or a father. And maybe you've shared them with your kids. Let us know. 866-780-9100. You can also send us email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. And Jess on Twitter said, Laura taught us to make our imaginations come alive. She took us back to the olden days, and thankfully our parents introduced us to her. Betty was talking about many of the sites, the Laura sites throughout the Midwest, and of course, because the family traveled around so much, there are many yes. Laura sites around the Midwest. Amy, when did you first go see those sites?
You know, the first time I went, I turned 18 in June of 1990, and being the rebel that I was, I decided to go on a road trip to all the Laura sites.
So many other 18-year-olds
in 1990. Just like so many 18-year-olds in 1990. A good friend of mine, Maria, and I just tossed a tent in our sleeping bags in the back of my 80 Granada, and we went looking for Pepin first. I grew up in Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, which is not very far from Pepin. And still, we got lost trying to find it because they had just changed the roadmaps over. There was a renumbering system or something. But we went to Pepin, and we camped out near there, and we went to Walnut Grove. And this was before William Anderson's wonderful The Little House Guidebook came out. So I didn't know that Desmet was only another hour and a half down the road, or I would have kept going.
Yeah. Yes, if anybody's planning a trip, you really want a copy of Little House Guidebook by Bill Anderson.
It's just fabulous.
Be aware, though, that even though he updates it periodically, sometimes he doesn't update the hours at the museum, so call ahead or check their websites.
All right, so you don't arrive at just the wrong time.
Yeah.
People have.
I'm sure. How about you, Sarah? When did you first start visiting these sites?
Well, I was very fortunate to have a very supportive family. My mom believed that if we were interested in something, you should go the extra mile. So my first site was Burr Oak when I was, must have been 1983. Was the first one I went. And then she took me around. Well, she mostly it was me, my brother, and my grandparents, my mom, and we went around to pretty much all the sites, except we hadn't gotten to Independence and we hadn't gotten to Malone. But I have done those now, so I have been to all the major sites and have gone back quite a few times. In fact, like I'm going to be when we were at Laura Palooza, the Laura Ingalls Wilder Conference this summer, I was at Burr Oak and Spring Valley and Walnut Grove on the way. And then I'm going to be going back up to Pepin for to be the speaker for their Laura Days in a couple weeks. So it's always a great thing to go and to come back again and visit the sites. Really, there's so many different experiences that you can have.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Laura Palooza, Amy, because I know you were the chief organizer behind that, and it was mm-hmm. a conference about all things Laura Ingalls Wilder. What was the idea behind that?
Well, you know, this is an idea that's been brewing among several of us who've kind of connected online for quite some time, including Sarah Sue here mm-hmm. and Sandra Hume and Connie Newman and Johnny Craven and Rebecca Brammer, these people who we're all just diehard Laura people. mm-hmm. And a few years ago, we sort of got together, those of us who could, at Independence for a day get-together where we could share Laura in February. And it was raining and it was cold and it made you really appreciate being in Kansas in February. And We started talking then about how it would be nice to have sort of a larger venue where we could sort of throw open the gates and say, what have you got that you'd like to share? What can we share with each other? Because we knew very well that there are more than just us who were interested in this topic. But I don't think any of us was quite prepared for just how many people were interested. I came to MSU Mankato in the fall of 2008. And I realized that Mankato is probably the perfect place to have a LoRa conference because it's right on the Laura Ingalls Wilder Memorial Highway, which is Highway 14 that takes you from Pepin all the way, pretty much from Pepin all the way over to Desmet, and hits sites along the way. And my faculty here were enthusiastic and supportive of the idea of having it here, and the university said, well, sure. And so we met in the summer of 2009, again, this time in Desmet, to sort of flesh out proposals or a call for proposals and ideas for the conference. And from there, we just sort of threw it out to cyberspace and the rest of the world and said, we're doing this. Do you want to come? And we had 152 people pre-registered for LoRapalooza this summer, and we had more than 20 people each day come for the day, for day passes in addition to that. So it was much bigger than I originally anticipated. In fact, I had to rebook extra space. I originally just had one conference room that could serve about 75 people. And we ended up splitting up the big ballroom here at the Centennial Student Union, which could work with 500 when it's opened up. And we split it up. So it was an amazing experience. We had people from everywhere, not only attending, but also presenting papers. I wasn't prepared for the sheer number of people who were doing research. Everybody from, well, Sarah here, who talked about the publishing aspect of the industry, to Barbara Mays-Busted, who is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service, who talked about conditions during the hard winter. We just had an amazing number of presentations and a very good group of people. And that includes Dean Butler, who played Almanzo Wilder on the television series, who attended as a guest, or as a conference attendee. He was there for all 3 days and showed his LoRa documentaries that haven't been shown to many people. So we felt very privileged.
So were you surprised? I mean, in academia, have you had anybody kind of blow off your interest in LoRa Ingalls Wilder? Like, that's not something that academics should be digging into?
You know, no.
Okay, good.
which is a very good thing, right? And part of that is my field is mass media. I'm a former journalist and I'm a media historian. And so the work that I have done with Laura Ingalls Wilder and Rose Wilder Lane has really been an act of women's history and recovery, because it's about giving them their rightful places in my field. But the other part of that is, as a cultural historian, we really need to discuss pop culture. We need to understand what popular culture is and how people are interacting with it, because that tells us a lot about what was going on in any given time period, what's popular. Laura's books, for example, are not popular just because they talk about the 19th century and pioneer life, but also because they resonated with people who were going through similar movement during the Great Depression. So there's a lot of things that we can talk about here. So no, I haven't run into any roadblocks in pursuing my love of LoRa on an academic level.
And I'd just like to put in that as membership chair, if you want to be a member of the organization that support LoRapalooza, that you can still do that. And the information is on beyondlittlehouse.com. We're having another conference in 2012. Mm-hmm. And also, if you want to just see what this one was like, also on Beyond Little House is the links to the videos that I did.
Yeah.
I'd say they gave kind of a flavor of it, didn't you, Amy?
They were fantastic, Sarah Sue. although I didn't like the way I looked in any of them.
that's a discussion for another time.
Completely different discussion. But yeah,
right.
it really gives you a flavor for what it was like to be at the conference. And some of the most popular parts of it, too, like our spelling bee.
We got
it.
That does sound like fun. We got an email from Jeffrey who says, the writings and stories you speak of are about a time before celebrity culture and the trivial noise of our modern society. Laura Ingalls and her rural enclave speaks to my heart, and I've introduced the works to all of my daughters, even though we're big city folks. And now he wants to know when he can take them to see a performance, which I was going to mention in just a moment. Sarah, you're going to be at the Hoover Museum, the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch this weekend, because this is a Labor Day tradition at the Hoover Museum. You'll be there on Monday?
I'll be there on Monday. And Monday is the Laura Ingalls Wilder Remember Day at the Hoover Library. And there will be a performance at 1 and I think it's 3:30. And I'm going to be doing a brand new program on Laura. I do a brand new one for Hoover every year. The Marengo Civil War Band is going to be playing songs from the books and explaining where the songs come from and how they fit in. They also have prairie walks through the National Park Service. And it's just a really great day. I would recommend, if you're coming, you might want to try for the second show, because normally what happens is the first show, they've literally pulled out every chair in the place, and the second show, there's a little room. So if you're planning on coming, the second show is better. The Hoover Library is the home of the Laura Ingalls Wilder, Rose Wilder Lane papers, which our caller talked about getting to see for the research. So that's why they have this Laura event, because the place to research Laura, well, one of the major places to research Laura is at the Hoover Library, which is just great. It's one of three big connections we have to Laura in Iowa. We have that she lived in Burr Oak from 1867 to 1877, that her papers are at the Hoover Library, and then Mary did attend the Iowa School for the Blind, now called Ann Sight Saving School, in Vinton, Iowa, which they have a museum on their third floor that if you want to visit, you can.
All right. Well, Sarah Utoff, thank you so much for your time today. She's a reference librarian at Kirkwood Community College and travels around and gives speeches about Laura Ingalls Wilder, portraying Laura Ingalls Wilder. You can find more about her on her website, trundlebedtales.com. And Amy Lauders is an assistant professor at Minnesota State University, Mankato. And you can find more about her at beyondlittlehouse.com. Thank you both so much today.
Thanks for having me.
Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News.